From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we recap some of the interviews from our summer-long series on agriculture called Full Plates.
First, a look at the noble goals of the slow food movement in the United States.
Not only are you improving our local economy, you are reducing your carbon footprint and helping ensure that more of your neighbors are making a fair wage.
Later, why writer Anna Blessing believes what farmers in our region are doing is nothing less than heroic.
And a Milwaukee writer's new book highlights the science behind food preservation.
I don't need you to know formulas to do the canning, but you just need to know what salt and sugar are doing in a chemical sense. And that's easy to understand, and it's also easier to understand when you're actually doing it. It becomes like a physical proof of concept.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're currently in prime farmers market season here in Wisconsin, a time when many of us take the time to think about the origins of our food. In recent years, the farm-to-table movement has encouraged people to support local agriculture at home and in restaurants.
But before farm-to-table, the watchword was slow food. The movements are closely linked. Both stress the connections between the people who grow, produce, and prepare food.
Jennifer Casey is the Wisconsin governor of Slow Food USA and the executive director of the Fondy Food Center. She sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and offered a more precise definition of just what slow food is.
Slow Food is an international organization that is dedicated to inspiring people to create a better, more fair, and more delicious food system. It's an international organization that functions in 150 countries around the world. Locally, we have a chapter. We have about four chapters statewide.
Okay. So when we say more delicious, more fair, what do we mean by that?
One of the interesting things about the industrial food system is that while it's done a really good job of delivering high volumes of very cheap food, it's pitted two groups of stakeholders against each other. Those are the farmers on one hand and the farm workers on one hand, and then there are the consumers on the other hand. It's very hard for a farmer to make a livable wage these days. It's very hard for a farm worker to make a livable wage, and that's because we as consumers have come to expect that food is going to be very cheap. So fair food is food that allows farmers and food producers to make a living wage. At the same time, when you increase food prices, that negatively impacts those most vulnerable. It impacts people who have trouble making ends meet. And so what we work to do, those of us working in the good food movement, including within Slow Food and the local farmers market system, we try and create more access points so more people have greater access to good food.
So when I was reading about the slow food movement, to me it seemed like there were a lot of parallels with the farm-to-table movement. How do those two line up?
Well, there's been a lot of interconnectivity over the years. I can start by saying when I first moved to Milwaukee, it was over a decade ago, and Slow Food Wisconsin Southeast, our local chapter of Slow Food, was one of the only groups in Milwaukee that was working on food systems work, working on connecting people to farmers and to food producers. And a lot of what that chapter was doing at that time was farm-to-table stuff, working with different chefs, doing farm tours. And as, you know, the years have progressed, we've seen a remarkable uptick in the variety and number of organizations and efforts that are addressing a better food system. And that could be through food justice efforts, through community gardens, through supporting farmers markets and farmers, and finding ways for beginning and low-resource farmers to get access to the resources that they need to be successful.
So why is it important to hook up, you know, a consumer with a farmer? What's the difference getting your produce from a farmer than getting your produce from the grocery store or wherever else you might buy produce?
Well, when you buy direct, more of that dollar goes to the farmer. And more of that dollar stays in the local economy. The other thing is that you're shortening the food system chain. Right now, you know, most of your food travels at least 1,500 miles to get to you. When you go to a farmer's market, a producer-only farmer's market, where the farmers have been growing their produce or raising their animals, and then they're coming from the surrounding area, you're shortening those food miles and reducing your carbon footprint. So not only are you improving our local economy, you are reducing your carbon footprint and helping ensure that more of your neighbors are making a fair wage.
Well, and kind of on this same line, you have a talk coming up at the Milwaukee Public Museum about food biodiversity. Now, I think a lot of the time when we think of agriculture, we think of it as being this kind of unique system unto itself. Why is biodiversity important in our food systems?
Well, there are many ways I could answer that. I will start by saying we have seen a dramatic decrease in food biodiversity over the last 100 years. This is a problem because diversity is a marker of strength and resilience in any system. It doesn't matter what sort of system you're looking at. And as industrial agriculture has risen, that's led to situations such as the majority of nutrients eaten across the globe come from three crops: corn, wheat, and rice. As those have continued to gain prominence, we've dramatically lost nutrition opportunities. So as you decrease the numbers and diversity of foods that you're eating, you experience less nutrition, which is why, in part, why we have more diet-related chronic diseases. And it also creates a more fragile food system, meaning that we don't have the diversity and the resilience to face climate change or other unexpected futures. So I can give an example. Here in the States, there once existed over 15,000 unique varietals of apples. These days, you go to a grocery store and you might find the Granny Smith, Red Delicious, Fuji, and most of those are coming from Washington State or Australia, from quite far away. There are a handful of orchards that are still raising numerous heirloom varieties, and you can find those interesting heirloom varieties like the Wolf River apple from Wisconsin or the local Milwaukee apple, which is a very endangered apple. Only a few trees exist that are producing fruit. You can find those at the orchards by visiting the orchards, seeking those out, or by going to your farmer's market. They still exist, but they're quite endangered.
So how is Slow Food, the movement and the organization, how is it working to increase biodiversity among growers?
Slow Food is working to increase food biodiversity primarily through its Arc of Taste project. What the Arc of Taste is an international catalog of rare and delicious foods worth saving. So the catalog is a place for people to learn about these foods and to identify foods that are from their area that they might want to grow in their gardens, raise on their farms, cook in their restaurants, share with friends. It's a way for growers, for farmers, for orchardists, for chefs to conserve biodiversity at home and in their work.
How much of this is preserving our history in a lot of ways through food?
Absolutely. It's preserving our cultural and our culinary heritage. So the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN's FAO, estimates that in the U.S. alone, we've lost 95% of the foods historically consumed. That means they no longer exist. What projects like the Arc of Taste do is to get those foods back into production and onto our plates. It's an effort to eat it, to save it. And it's a very joyful effort. There's a lot of amazing work trying to make the world a better place. There are a lot of issues to work on. But the great thing about working in the food system and working on biodiversity is it allows it to be a joyful work. You come to our farmers market, let's say the Fondi Farmers Market, on a Saturday in August, and you will find one of the most diverse spaces, one of the most diverse spaces in Milwaukee, which is known for being one of the most segregated cities. With that human diversity comes culinary diversity. You'll get recipes from our primarily Hmong refugee farmers. You'll learn about the best way to make collard or turnip greens. And on that Saturday in August, you might find 13 different varieties of eggplants. You know, they can be small, the size of a pea, up to the big, large globe Italian eggplant. And they all have different uses and different histories and different stories.
And I think, especially in Milwaukee, it's hard to see kind of how the slow food movement fits into, you know, what is really a city, what is a very urban environment. How does the slow food movement function in a city setting?
One of the things that slow food does well is to connect the urban with the rural. So a lot of people living in city centers do not grow their own food. They aren't necessarily close to the means of production. Slow food can, through food tours and farm tours, connect city dwellers with the folks responsible for bringing us the amazing food that comes into the city. But also, there is a huge amount of urban ag that goes on. I think later this month, the Victory Garden Initiative's Garden Blitz will be installing hundreds of raised bed gardens. Each of those gardens has an opportunity to grow Arc of Taste plants. So, for instance, that's how I got into the Arc of Taste. I was a home gardener, always in city environments, and I was interested in finding unique and storied plants to grow in my garden that would be delicious. And luckily, there are a lot of places where you can now find Arc of Taste vegetables like the Beaver Dam pepper, which has been grown in Wisconsin for over 100 years, or the Amish paste tomato, which is an incredible tomato for making sauce. Aunt Molly's ground cherry is another example of a plant that's been really popular here in Milwaukee that's on the Arc of Taste. There have been hundreds of Aunt Molly's ground cherries, which they look like little tomatillos, but you eat them fresh and they taste like cherries, a cross between a tomato and a cherry. A husk tomato is another name for it. But that's an example of a plant that people are growing in their backyards or in their raised bed gardens or even in pots on their front porches.
Ultimately, why do you think it's important for people to have a better understanding of where their food comes from and the history of their food?
I think with the loss of food literacy, we've allowed corporations to make choices for us. So as people have become more divorced, have gotten further and further away from where their food comes from, as a society, we've become less healthy. We've become blind to the negative environmental impacts of the industrial food system. The way that we eat shapes not just ourselves and our communities, but the entire world around us. Agriculture is one of the leading forces behind climate change, behind water pollution. So whether or not you are a fancy cook, or you're just a home gardener, or somebody that's interested in feeding their family, seeking out local food producers, farmers, farmers market is something that can improve your own family's nutrition, can help you celebrate with your community members, and have a greater impact on the world around us.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
Jennifer Casey is the executive director of the Fondi Food Center and the Wisconsin governor of Slow Food USA. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
The slow food movement is, at its core, a reaction to fast food culture and a push to preserve traditional local cuisine.
In many ways, these concepts are embodied by the practice of foraging. And while it may not be as common as it once was, there are still those among us who live and profit from the fruit of the land, or in this case, the fungi of the land.
WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz spoke with a local forager known as Mushroom Mike, who has built a business on foraging.
Mike Joswick's parents both taught science in Racine, Wisconsin. Growing up for him meant exploration, and along with it, foraging. Mushrooms topped the list, but the family also plucked edible flowers and plants others might consider a nuisance, things like nettles and burdock. On a wooded parcel outside Cross Plains, Wisconsin, a 20-minute drive west of Madison, Joswick spies what he considers a perfect specimen. Shovel in hand, Joswick says it's not the leaves he's after, but the burdock roots.
You had to go straight down with the burdock because it's got a very straight root.
Joswick carefully extracts and gently shakes the roots free of soil.
So you trim it off right here. You clean it up, wash it down, and then you can shave it like with a carrot peeler and then roast them, or you can just roast them, just roots on it all, and then shave it off and then use it as a starch substitute.
Joswick discovered many chefs like the results as much as he does, so he harvests the plants and sells them directly to restaurants and at farmers markets.
There's so much of this stuff too, and you can spend you can get a solid 15, 20 pounds an hour digging burdock on a farm.
The 33-year-old earned a master's in sustainable really like development of natural resources and decided to concentrate on Wisconsin's natural resources, the edible ones. He has struck up relationships with farmers, like the one who owns this land. His woods also teem with mushrooms. Joswick, who hunts with equal gusto, explains how their relationship came to life.
He had a turkey hunting lease opportunity on Craigslist. I came out here, hunted turkeys, then I offered the opportunity. Awesome. I was like, well, is there something we can do in terms of this? And he goes, well, yeah, I don't pick morels. He goes, I know we got morels. Just kind of developed that way.
Joswick casts a wide net when mushroom foraging.
We're going to go down and start chanterelle season in Missouri this year. Okay. And do smooth chanterelles. Beautiful, just flower petal. It looks like a daylily. And then we'll go up and do pine chanterelles in northern Wisconsin. And then we go to lobster mushrooms, and then we go to hedgehogs. And we
but mushrooms in the wild are just a piece of Joswick's growing business. He also cultivates microgreens in a converted warehouse in Milwaukee's Walker's Point neighborhood.
Come on in.
Joswick and his dad are cultivating mushrooms, 18 species and counting, in specially designed and monitored chambers.
So we basically mix everything by hand with the proper ratios, bag everything, and then they go into our sterilizer systems. And we sterilize them overnight, or roughly for about 6 to 8 hours, and then let it cool down, and then we bring them into kind of the closed circuit of production over here.
Joswick's brain is a never-ending reservoir of possible projects, especially when it involves mushrooms. We visit a fellow Walker's Point entrepreneur at Indulgence Chocolatier to learn the latest.
My name's Julie Waterman. He brought us these really amazingly fragrant dried candy cap mushrooms, and they just burst with scents of like maple syrup, and they've got this slightly savory note to them too. And we realized we have a chocolate from Ghana. It's got a lot of natural caramel tones, so that maple and that caramel together with that sweet milk chocolate.
The candy cap mushroom chocolate bar was born. Mike Joswick smiles and slips away. He has more mushrooms to grow and deliveries to make.
All right, we'll be in touch.
Mike Joswick is a local forager and the founder of Mushroom Mike LLC. For some tips on foraging and to learn more about his work, you can find your way over to WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then hear some of the compelling stories of traditional farmers learning to evolve with modern advances. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're a long time removed from the era in which farming represented the majority of the region's economy. But there are still many people who make a living on the farm in this part of the state and in the region.
A few years back, we spoke with Chicago writer Anna Blessing, who profiled some compelling stories of farms in Wisconsin and across the region in a book called Locally Grown. In her acknowledgments in the book, Blessing termed the farmers she met heroes, and she explained to us why.
Once I really started to get to know these farmers, and it started just being an eater and a shopper of farmers markets and just getting to know the farmers who I was shopping from, it made me want to know so much more about them, and it kind of was what started this whole book idea. And once I really started to get to visit their farms and see what they were doing, they are my heroes because what they are doing is some of the hardest work that I've ever seen in my life. You know, it's they work from literally dawn till well past dark, frequently lighting their fields with headlights to, you know, harvest. And they're such hard workers, and they do this thing that's so unpredictable, that's so based on the weather, and it's so hard. But they're so creative, these farmers, the way that they're farming in this small-scale, sustainable, I say artisanal, because I think that it's not just about growing 2,000 acres of corn. It's about growing this variety and these heirloom vegetables or these heritage breeds of animals that is... It's truly an art form, and what they're doing it's that combination between the science and the art, and they're doing this very essential thing, which is growing food for us to eat. And so that's superhero to me.
What were you shooting for as you cast your net? So was there a certain geographic diversity or ingredient diversity, I guess crop diversity that would be?
Absolutely. I was looking for diversity of types of farms, scale of farms, and definitely throughout the Midwest, so I could get kind of just a cross-section. You know, it's not comprehensive. I hope people go and seek out their own farmers, the stories that they can find in their own regions. But I started out with talking to Chicago chefs, and I asked them, who are your favorite farmers? Who are the ones, you know, who you've worked with the longest or who are doing really neat things, you know, with their farms and what they're growing or raising? And that was sort of started my list, and I started kind of compiling it from there.
How did the chefs reach out and find these farmers? Because many of them are really off the beaten path.
Absolutely. And, you know, in Chicago, it's such a great community of chefs who really work together and share their resources and their farmers. So maybe it started with a handful of chefs like Bruce Sherman and Rick Bayless who've been doing it for the past 20 years. And it slowly has just been growing since then, you know, and it's those farmers or those chefs, rather, helped get farmers to the farmers market in Chicago. A lot of chefs actually just found their farmers through going to places like Green City Market in Chicago, talking to other chefs who work with farmers, saying, what's your list? Who can I find? And, you know, they really share that information. It's a great community.
Well, and I gather there's some conversation that goes the other way. A farmer is looking for some place to sell his or her food to, mm-hmm. and if this chef can't use it, the chef might know of somebody else that can use it.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the biggest focuses of my book is that there is this community. It's so dependent on this community, this whole local food movement between the community of the farmers, the community of the chefs, and then of course the relationship that they have together. And I think that the farmers have done such an amazing job of starting to organize themselves. So, you know, maybe a farmer is able to reach out to chefs, so they had a connection, but there are these communities, these areas that are getting together and finding ways to reach chefs. So there's a Spence Farm in Illinois. Marty and Chris have Stewards of the Land, which was started in 2005, and they actually organize 25 local farms. And there's smaller farms that might not be able to have, you know, the resources to reach out to chefs. And they sort of compile everything that's available and present it to the chefs every week. So that's a really cool thing, a way to kind of reach chefs that way.
It's like an unofficial co-op.
Exactly. And it's a way that, you know, more farmers who really wouldn't have the resources to be able to reach those chefs in maybe other cities can do that. Rink DeVee and Jenny Bond at Shooting Star Farm here at Mineral Point, Wisconsin, they kind of do a similar thing with Green and Green, and they kind of bring these farmers together so that they can sell their food to chefs elsewhere.
How does what these farmers are doing speak to both the diminishing numbers of family farms out there and also the rise in sustainable farming practices?
These farmers, and part of the reason I really wanted to focus on them and tell their stories is because they realized that they had to, I say, refashioning the family farm. They had to find a new way to do it because the farms that were in existence that were generational family farms, places like Gunther Farms or Becker Lane Organic, those are farms that have been around for 4 or 5 generations, and they were failing because of the major industry, huge farms that were pushing them out.
Right. Was it Becker that was at one point selling their pigs for the same price that they were selling
absolutely.
For in the Depression?
Yeah, I mean, both of them, because they're both hog farmers, and that's exactly right. And it's they realized that if we're going to make this farm work, we have to do something different. So they used the same methods that maybe the grandfather was using, keeping the pigs outside, you know, keeping that same sustainability that was sort of natural, inherent in traditional farming, But then they started to reach out to chefs. And in some ways, chefs have really become, they're sort of the baseline for this movement succeeding. They're the spokesman for the farmers. They support them. They allow them to do these creative things. I mean, Greg Gunthorpe, with his hog farm, he actually has a USDA-certified processing plant on his farm, which is unheard of because he's so small, and that's the USDA doesn't just go throwing plants everywhere.
You're right. He had to drag them kicking and screaming to
exactly.
come out there.
Exactly. And that, and he probably couldn't have done that if he didn't have the support of these chefs who wanted his meat, and he wanted to be able to process it in a way that he approved of, and he wanted to be able to butcher it for, you know, cuts that chefs would want. So it's this relationship is so important. You know, a lot of these farmers have transformed the family farm and made it so that they can survive on maybe 120 acres. But it's really important to have the relationship with those chefs.
The other thing that that you write about that shows up quite a bit is really the sense of loyalty these chefs have to many of these family farms.
Yeah, I always say that chefs are hard to pin down, except when you ask them about their farmers, and then you can get them to sit and talk for like hours about their farmers. I mean, they every one of them will say it started out with finding food that tasted good. I mean, that was the first priority. You know, we wouldn't do this if the food didn't taste good. But then once they got to know these farmers, and I think once everyone gets to know these farmers, there's so many stories, and they're just these people with these rich histories and interests, and they're irresistible, you know? And I think the chefs have developed these relationships that it is so much more than just, you know, a farmer providing food to a chef. And they become friends, and they become practically extended family members, and they collaborate on things together. And it's this really, really cool relationship.
Would you say, are these farms together almost developing a template for how it can be done?
I think they are. I mean, I think, you know, we're still trying to find a way that it can be done in a scalable way. It is sort of based on a network and patchwork of farms, you know, and even the chefs who are working with farmers, one farmer can't provide everything that chef needs. So they, you know, a chef may work with as many as 40 farmers in a given year. But I think that these farms are the way to, I mean, they are providing models. And that's part of the thing, too, is that I wanted to tell their stories and I wanted to celebrate them, but I also wanted to provide maybe a template or guides. And that's why I also asked farmers to provide their resources and inspiration. So, you know, maybe other farmers who are looking to do this can kind of have a starting point. And hopefully we'll reach out to these farmers and get some advice.
Well, and scalability seems to be a big issue because it seems like there were plenty of these farmers who started it out. But once a chef and a restaurant is interested, there has to be a consistent supply.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that they're just now kind of, I mean, over the past 10 years, farmers are really learning to do that and trying to make that work. And I think that as the relationship sort of evolves, I think the chefs will realize that they really do need to kind of support these farmers in a consistent way. So maybe it's not just about showing up to the market or seeing what's on the email list for that week, but saying, I want this many pounds of tomatoes from you every week. I want this much red bib lettuce from you every week. So it's kind of that part's dependable for the farmers, and then they can go off and do creative things and grow smaller crops and...
Well, right. Variety is an interesting issue as well, because these are typically much smaller than commercial-sized farms. But that does not mean that they are producing fewer varieties.
Not at all. And they do that through—there's a lot of crop rotation, so they're switching up their crops a lot. I mean, the varieties are just unbelievable with some of these farms. And that's what's so exciting, is that they're able to produce so much variety within a small space, and that's also what makes it that they can survive and they can stay viable to the chefs.
It's significant to note that not all the farms you profile in this book are, strictly speaking, organic farms or
right.
certified organic farms. But that is not to say that they don't all hew to an organic or sustainable philosophy. How does that equation work for these farms?
I always say to people who are so used to looking for that designated organic label that it really is just about getting to know your farmer. You know, we hear that so much, know your farmer. That's what you need to do, because certified organic doesn't quite mean what it used to. It's gotten a little bit watered down. We're used to looking for that label as being sort of, you know, okay, this is okay now.
It's been blessed.
Yes. Right. And it's a good starting point to start thinking about food like this. But if you don't see it, it doesn't necessarily mean that farm or farmer is not growing organically. And it might be that just that the cost was prohibitive for them to get certified organic. It is an expensive process. It's a tedious process. And I think when it comes down to it, and there are places like McClug or Seedling, Southwest Michigan fruit farms, where it's nearly impossible to grow fruit organically. That doesn't mean that they don't take, you know, major measures to grow as sustainably as they can. They use integrated pest management to try to track their pests and manage it that way. What people, I think is that when something's certified organic or when something's organic, that means that it's, you know, you plant your seed and you let it grow. And that's not true. There are still sprays and inputs. They're just organic input. And in fact, Mick Klug, in speaking with Abby Klug, there are organic chemicals that are allowed to be certified organic that they wouldn't use and they wouldn't feel comfortable using on their crops. Because you do still have to spray those crops, those organic crops. So it's just a matter of sort of the balance of it. And, you know, so I think I always tell people you just really do have to ask your farmer. If you don't see the USDA certified organic, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't buy from them. You need to get to know the story.
And again, even if they are not certified organic, there's a certain interest in sustainability that all these farms have that you profile.
Absolutely. And I think that these farmers are interested in keeping the land healthy and sustainability, not just with the land and how they're treating their crops, but, you know, paying living wages to their workers, just the kind of the whole system that they're interested in farming sustainably. But, you know, I think that they would all say, too, is that when you grow this way and you really use what nature has put out for these what the systems that nature has, that's your soil's healthy, your food tastes better. You know, your soil is rich in nutrients, your food has more nutrients. So it really just becomes this. Sometimes it's more work, but it makes sense once you start tasting that food and you see it. So I think that's another really inspiring thing is to see that happening and working.
This must have been kind of a fun assignment.
It was such a fun assignment. I feel so lucky to have gotten to just go hang out on farms all last summer. More and more, you know, we don't go to farms. We don't experience being on a farm, and I certainly hadn't. And getting to visit all of these farms, it was, I mean, I just say again and again, it is like magic. You know where our food comes from in an abstract way, even if we've seen a carrot come out of the ground. But to really go there and see it, it's just magic. You see a seed and you're like, how does this happen from this? And every single time, I'm just blown away by it. So,
well, and you also did the photography for this book. These are, I don't know, fairly photogenic places.
They are. They're beautiful. And I think that part of the beauty is in like the little bit of the disheveled, messy kind of unkemptness of what these smaller farms are. You know, and you don't see the pristine roads and you don't see the, you know, flawless, weed-free tracks between the crops. But that's sort of what makes them, I think, gives them their beauty.
Well, so most of us aren't about to go out and open a restaurant. So what do you think, aside from the beauty and the remarkable story that each of these farms has, what is the takeaway message that you hope people who might pick up this book might carry with them?
I mean, I really hope that it starts a conversation is continuing a conversation for many, but starts a conversation too, because it is about starting to talk to these farmers, and a lot of us have access to great farmers markets in the Midwest, and it's going beyond just going and getting your weekly food there, but starting to talk to the farmers. I mean, we have this incredible gift of having the person who grew our food standing right there before us, and you can ask them anything, you know what I mean? And I think I want to encourage people to read these stories and want to know more about their own farmers in their own regions. And I have a 2-year-old, and she's just entered her why stage. And for me, it, you know, might make my days challenging, but I sort of encourage people to go back to that 2-year-old state of mind and start asking your farmers why. Why are these eggs blue? Why do you have this many varieties of radishes? Why are you growing the food you're growing? You know, why are you organic? Why aren't you organic? And just start asking those questions to start learning more.
Anna Blessing, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
Anna Blessing speaking on Lake Effect in 2012 about her book, Locally Grown. You can find all of the interviews in our Full Plate series at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, our Full Plate series continues with a conversation about how to preserve your garden's bounty. We'll chat with Milwaukee County's master food preserver when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Throughout the summer, we're exploring agriculture in southeastern Wisconsin in our Full Plate series. Our definition of agriculture is wide. We're talking about everything from backyard gardens to humanely raised and slaughtered meat, from which consumers are buying what kind of produce to the migrant workers who harvest our food.
Earlier this summer, we spoke with Christina Ward about home food preservation. From canning to fermenting to dehydrating, Christina is an expert in teaching Milwaukeeans how to put food by. Her new book is called, aptly enough, Preservation, and she says that among the many professional hats that she wears, there's one she's particularly proud of.
I'm a master food preserver for Milwaukee County. I had a fight with the state to get the accreditation because they didn't believe that a city, an urban area, needed this old rural program of teaching people the safest way to preserve food. But as we all know, Milwaukee's on the cutting edge of the urban agriculture movement. And so with all the folks with guerrilla gardens, with the victory gardens, with all the garden plots that we have around the city, you're going to grow a lot of stuff, and you need to figure out how you're going to extend the life of it. And so preservation, it's something I grew up doing and I'm really interested in. So I've been teaching it in coordination with the University of Wisconsin, the Extension Office. That's who's the authorizing body. So I'm the Master Food Preserver, which means I'm a volunteer in my community charged with giving people the latest and greatest science.
Wow, I didn't even know that that was like a state job.
It's a volunteer job, and it's really, it's kind of cool, the history of it, because it comes from that post-Civil War era of the westward expansion and the idea of an old land-grant university. And so people may be more familiar with the Master Gardener program, and again, that's through the extension. The idea is it's an extension of the university, that a university like Madison is taxpayer, has some taxpayer support, and what the university gives back is knowledge. And the extension programs are about that outreach, about sharing that knowledge. And so when you're talking about for Master Food Preserver program, for example, at Wisconsin, they do a lot of the microbiological testing, equipment testing, and then they share that information throughout the country and then with other Master Food Preservers around the country to make sure that the science that they did gets out to the people.
So talk a little bit about the accreditation that you had to do to get this, which then, of course, led you to write this very extensive book about the preservation of food.
So the studying I had to do was, again, it's an interesting program in the sense that to become a part of it, you have to prove knowledge. So you come in having to have a practical applied knowledge. You have to know how to do it already. And then the university does the further testing and education. So I had to actually take like a written exam. I had to do practicals, which is they give you a recipe and you had to make it correctly with Dr. Barbara Ingram. And she's looking over your shoulder, making sure you're doing it absolutely correctly. And she will absolutely tell you if it's wrong. And so going through that process, you know, gives you that structure and gives you access to the newest information, which, again, we tried to share with everybody. And it teaching, I love teaching. I love sharing for information. I'm a firm believer that information is something that wants to be out there. I'm not a fan of kind of that. There's sometimes in food culture you see it with hoarding of information, that somebody knows how to do something and they're the only person that knows how to do it. I'm the opposite. So I partnered early on with the Milwaukee Public Schools, with the Recreation Department, to be able to teach food preservation in all its forms.
And that's in the first part of the book, you describe going into the kitchen, which basically was a stove and a sink.
Yes. Yeah. There's lots of kitchens, the old home ec kitchens throughout Milwaukee Public Schools and the rec centers. I've been in some fancy kitchens and I've been in the middle of a field. With some of the bare requirements, like running water or some heat, you can preserve food. And so the idea was to take it down, keep it where it was, where it started, food preservation started, which was a practical skill that you needed to do to stay alive. And not a gourmet thing. Now, it's fun to do the gourmet stuff and to make things taste really good and do a little experimentation. But at its core, this is a practical life skill that has use today in modernity.
Yeah, it's a practical life skill. It's also a science-based skill because you have to understand, you know, how microbes work, and you have to understand what heat does to things and what pickling does and all of those chemical processes as well.
And that was really the motivation for writing the book, because one, there's so much of the high level science out there, and I digested that going through, you know, the Master Food Preserver training program as well as my own research. And then there's the kind of folklore. And between the two, it can be difficult to understand and scary sometimes. And so I think that my idea, it's how I teach people, is to take the science, make those concepts relatively easy to understand. So I don't need you to know formulas to do the canning, but you just need to know what salt and sugar are doing in a chemical sense. And that's easy to understand. And it's also easier to understand when you're actually doing it. It becomes like a physical proof of concept. You get to say, oh, I see the jelly gelling. I know why now. And it also gives you confidence when you're doing it.
Well, I think one of the things for those of us who grew up with mothers and grandmothers who canned all summer long, you know, as things were coming out of the garden, I can remember my mother standing over big hot things, you know, the boiling water for the jars and all of that. I think some of the fear of people who didn't do it themselves is that I'm going to have something explode in my pantry because it's got botulism.
that is a legitimate fear, and that's what we talk about. We're food preservation a little different than actual cooking. If you cook something poorly, you'll burn it. You can't eat it. If you can something poorly, one, you may not know you did it incorrectly if you don't understand what you're doing in the first place. And then the larger ramifications are something like botulism, which you can't see, you can't taste, you can't smell. So doing things correctly, understanding the science behind it and following the correct procedures helps you then prevent that from ever happening. Cases of botulism due to canning, food preservation are always, always, always because someone did it wrong. And they did it wrong because they either chose to ignore or just didn't understand the science behind it.
Take me through a basic, simple canning process. You know, let's pick something that's fresh right now. What's growing right now?
The strawberries are almost ready.
Okay.
Almost ready.
So we're going to make strawberry jam, you and me. How do I start?
So first of all, wash. That's the first thing. Wash your hands, wash your berries, wash everything. And then, believe it or not, take the greens off. I had one heartbreaking call of somebody, you know, oh, my strawberry jam turned brown and we troubleshoot, walk through it, and the poor lady, she didn't take the green stems off. Take the stems off. Take the green hulls out. So it's a very simple thing. It's a ratio. So you're to make a basic strawberry jam, 4 cups of berries, a little bit of lemon juice, which acts as a catalyst, there's your chemical term, to help break apart all of the cell walls, and that's your heat. You're going to put that into a pot with equal 4 cups of sugar. Yep, that's a lot. And it's not for sweetening. It's doing a job because sugar absorbs water. So again, any type of food preservation is really about erecting barriers against the microbes. It's a race. Who's going to eat the food first, you or the microbes? So sugar takes away water. Microbes need water. And so that essentially extends the life of that food, that strawberry jam. You cook it all up. The other thing that you can do is you cook it to a point where it becomes thick. That's through evaporation. Again, it's losing its water. Thanks to modern science, we have pectin you can add in. Pectin is a natural fiber. It's the thing that keeps the skin of the fruit together. Fruits that have thick skins have more pectin. Fruits that have thin skins don't have as much. So again, adding a pectin, you bring it up to a boil. It sets, it's jam. So you've got strawberry jam. You could stick it in the fridge and have it last a few weeks. You could put it in the freezer and have it last a few months. Or you could take the next step. You put it in jars and you put it in a hot water boiling canner. And all that means is it's submerged for a prescribed length of time. And after that, it creates, that's the physics of canning. It pushes all the available oxygen out, creates a hermetic seal. Nothing can get in. And there you go. You're 1 year to 18 months on your pantry shelf. That's it.
But you have to also sterilize those jars.
Well, sterilization is an interesting kind of term. So when we think about sterilization, we are thinking about grandmothers, you know, and boiling all the jars. What you forget sometimes, again, this is where we have the extension and the universities doing this research, is science marches forward. Hot soapy water. Hot soapy water is great. So you don't have to boil your jars. If you wash them in hot soapy water and rinse them right before you're going to use them, that's great. If you have a dishwasher, even better. Load them up, run the dishwasher cycle, leave them in there hot until you need them. Much easier.
Food preservation has been around as long as human beings have been around. And you talk about that with fermentation and dehydration, because those are two other ways of preserving food that you touch on.
All preservation is really about extension, extending the life of the food and erecting barriers against germs, against microbes. Fermentation, really interesting, because essentially you're bacterial farming. What you're doing is attracting good bacteria, good microbes that then drive out the bad ones. Again, when I'm talking to kids about food preservation, the thing to keep in mind is bacteria poop is acid. Yeast poop is alcohol. So if you're making beer or wine, that's where you're, the byproduct,
it's
that's
a
alcohol.
Great image, yeah.
So, and so really what we're doing is we're using fermentation is using attracting bacteria to create acid, to create a high acid environment. Again, microbes are symbiotic to humans. They want the same things we want. So when we create a high acid environment, either through fermentation or pickling, what we're doing is we're making the place not a happy home for germs, for microbes.
Right. And a happy place for the ones that work in our
systems
and feed our own biome.
Right. And that's where kombucha is interesting, because kombucha is then essentially it's both an acid and an alcohol, because it's the SCOBY. You hear the term SCOBY. That's both a bacterial and a yeast. And so to come back to this, is people have been doing this for time immemorial, since we started eating. The question that food scientists and food historians really haven't figured out yet is, why did someone start eating it? It's easy to understand how something got left out. You know, Krog, you know, the caveman pot left the fish too long and it started to go bad, i.e. ferment. But who decided to eat it? The same thing with something really dried out. So starvation, hunger plays a huge role in food history of how we decided to start eating things. And then who decided it was good? There are many foods all around the world that are definitely an acquired taste.
Right. And I'm also thinking of putting things together for a long winter, because here in Wisconsin, we have a long time where things aren't growing and we have to be able to save food. Like you say, extend the life of things. I grew up in New Hampshire, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the dried meats, you have the preserved vegetables, preserved fruits, and, you know, alcohols if you're making beer or cider. That is in the fall when you do the apples. So do you think that that is a large part of this, as well as that we were trying to hold on to things?
That is a huge part of it. It also, that discovery, you know, again, thousands and thousands of years ago, of something could be dried, something could be fermented, and then taken with you, was, you know, played a huge role in kind of the exploration age of the world. And that also goes to how people could then live in really harsh climates. Once they figured out, say, you know, Scandinavian countries are a really good example. They have a huge amount of both dried foods and fermented foods. Once they figured that out, how to do that, and that they like to eat that, that enabled them to live in climates that did not have a year-round growing season, just like us hardy folks in Wisconsin and from New Hampshire.
Yes, who have Scandinavian backgrounds.
So again, how and why we eat food and how we prepare it. And so this idea, this it's a very modern notion that you can go into a grocery store and buy an apple any day of the year. That is a wholly modern invention. I mean, modern meaning 20th century, really. The idea of refrigerated storage, refrigerated transport, bringing food in from other countries.
Right. And really like mid-20th century.
Mid-20th century. Yeah. Until then, if you couldn't grow it or get it in your own very close vicinity and then preserve it, you were out of luck. There are many stories. There's the great Wisconsin historical book called Wisconsin Death Trips, Michael Lazy, 1973. I'm always fond of it because it talks about the area where my grandmother's farm was, in that Osseo, Jackson County, Black River. And so you hear, using newspaper clippings and actual anecdotes, you hear these stories of people surviving the winter, and a lot of times not surviving the winter, whether they go cabin fever stir crazy or run out of food. It was a real thing that happened to people. And so that skill of preserving food was a critical life skill.
So here we are in 2017. People seem to be interested in acquiring that skill again. What do you think is behind the interest? It seems more and more people want to know how to do this.
I think there's a number of reasons people come to food preservation, which to me is always really interesting. So you see a bunch of people who come to, and I'm basing this based on who comes to classes. So there's folks that are wanting to reconnect to their own food history, that something maybe their grandmother did, they remember seeing, but they themselves never learned how to do it. So they want to reconnect to their personal food history. There's also more awareness about the chemical preservation, the chemicals that go into processed foods, and people are trying to remove those from their lives. So going back to an old way, this way of food preservation reduces the amount of chemicals that you would need, i.e. none. And so there's folks that do that. There's also people that want to preserve food based on some dietary necessities. So there are so many things like gluten that are just added to everything. So by preserving it yourself, you have a 100% total control over what you're eating. And then there's the economic reasons. If you're you're growing your own food and then able to preserve your food, you have high-quality food, say, in the winter or any time of year, that you have 100% control over, and some, you know, it gives you some economic stability.
Are you seeing people from all walks of life interested in this, different ages, different ethnicities?
Absolutely. And that's, to me, that's the best part of the Milwaukee Recreation classes. We keep them cheap and cheerful. I always say working classes for the working classes. The idea is you're coming in, you're making stuff, you're learning it, you're taking some things home. And the folks that are coming to those classes, because they are affordable, are everybody from, you know, grandmas trying to relearn the right way, updating the science, to we've had teenage girls who are going to start their business their next day after they know how to do it, and from all parts of the city of Milwaukee. My favorite part is when you're talking about food, food's always the equalizer among everybody. I don't care your political background or whatever your ideologies are. When people are talking about food, they're happy, and people love talking about their favorite foods and their favorite food memories, and, you know, what they're going to make and what they're going to eat, and exchanging ideas about what someone else is doing and trying it themselves. That's the best part.
It takes you back to your childhood in some cases, too.
It does. And that's where I think working with food and working together, there's something, there's that power of working as a group. And classes will start, everybody's as naturally, we're all, you know, adult classes. So people come in, they're a little quiet. It's after work, everybody's a little tired. By the end of the couple of hours, if we're doing it right, everybody's giggling and laughing and making bad jokes. And just, it's that time we spend together, making things, creating something together. I think that empowers us as humans.
Making bad jokes and making good food.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd rather have it that way than the other way around.
Absolutely. Yeah. Much, much happier that way. Well, Christina, it is such a pleasure to see you again, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
It is called Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration. And we are so pleased you were able to come in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Christina Ward is the master food preserver for Milwaukee County and the author of the new book, Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration. For more information on her book and to see the rest of the Full Plate series, head to WUWM.com. That's all for the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It is NPR in Milwaukee.
And it is 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.